Welcome to New Narrative Southeast Asia Dispatches. I'm your host, Bonibel Ramatan, editorial manager for New Narrative. New Narrative is a movement to democratize democracy in Southeast Asia, and this podcast is one of the ways we attempt to do just that. If you've been following us for a while, you're probably familiar with the Media Freedom in Southeast Asia project. This project strives to better understand the lived experiences of media workers when facing the increasingly hostile climate of Southeast Asia. Media Freedom Insights, the research arm of that project, is a series of New Narrative reports dedicated to the fight for media freedom in Southeast Asia. Our current Media Freedom Insights series, titled Engendering Media Freedom, showcases the gendered experiences of journalists in the region to map out an overview of the media freedom landscape. We've published findings from Malaysia, Singapore, and Brunei in July 2023, as well as insights from Indonesia and the Philippines in December 2023.
And I'm Wai Liang, the freedom expression researcher here at New Narrative.
That is Wai Liang Thum, the primary author of the aforementioned series. He is New Narrative's researcher and also an editor and literary scholar in training with a particular interest in memory studies.
I'm Avon from the Elder Media. I'm currently the national coordinator of the network.
That is Avon Ang, national coordinator of Elder Media. Elder Media is a national network of independent and progressive media outfits, institutions, and individuals in the Philippines. In this episode, we will talk about the second and third publications of the Engendering Media Freedom series, the role of Elder Media, and what to expect from our media freedom insights in the future. But let's just start with the research, right? It's been 7 months since the publication of the Engendering Media Freedom, Reconceptualizing Newsmaking in Southeast Asia, which we also talked about in this podcast. And you have very recently just published a follow-up to that. So can you tell us a bit more? It's Series 4, Publication 3, I believe. Can you tell us more about that?
To keep things very brief, each of the different reports that have been published as part of this series focus on different countries within Southeast Asia. So partly for the sake of convenience, but also because we felt that some cases in some countries were quite comparable to each other. We've decided each of the different reports focuses on different groups of countries. The latest report looks specifically at experiences of newsmakers of marginalized genders and sexualities in Indonesia and the Philippines. What we really want to emphasize is that New Narrative isn't specifically the subject matter expert here, because the real subject matter experts are those whom we spoke to and who shared their experiences with us. And our job was really sort of looking through their work on the ground, the challenges that they are facing. The challenges here, of course, are not just political, but economic as well. And what we found most interesting was that we could actually tease out some lessons learned from these interviews with our participants. And because we found that, well, rather than having to list out the different challenges in specific detail, we thought it might be quite productive to actually talk about what steps could be done to potentially mitigate the severity of some of these issues. This is not to say that our report is a definitive guide to surviving as a media worker, but rather we think that there might be some interesting lessons here that could be helpful in some context. Again, not necessarily just in Indonesia and the Philippines, but perhaps in other parts of the region as well, and maybe even further afield. But yeah, that's a very quick rundown on what to expect when you read through this report, which is available as a web post on New, on New Narrative's website.
Yeah, I don't think we've actually talked about the previous one as well. I mean, we did talk about research of as activism, and we can explore the connection, like the praxis for that in these countries. But just very quickly, you know, we have findings from Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei, Indonesia, and the Philippines right now. So it's already like five countries. Have you found any uniqueness or... You know, I believe there is a through line, obviously, because, you know, we all live in a pretty similar media climate in Southeast Asia. But can you talk us through some of your findings, some of the uniqueness, some of the unique things that you might have found there?
I think maybe we'll start with Singapore first, because Singapore is within Southeast Asia a bit of an exceptional case in the sense of a high degree of centralization. What we noticed was that rather than, you know, sort of like the image of the omnipresent censor authority, there's really quite a lot of flexibility on the ground for newsmakers to work. So there's quite a bit of independence because as put forward by some of our participants and in some of the literature that we've come across, if you're a media worker working for effectively working for under state institutions, you're sort of there because you're already expected to know how to do your job. So in this sense, there's quite a lot of agency that's afforded to the newsmakers themselves, but at the same time, they're very much constrained by sort of the broader systemic structure and institutional pressures which they work under. And we found this particularly interesting because I think in many respects, when we were looking, because we did speak to other newsmakers who worked in sort of state-linked institutions elsewhere, in Malaysia, for example, in Indonesia as well. And again, what was stressed was this degree of, I guess this degree, the certain degree of autonomy, a certain degree of agency that you can still express even under what seemed to be from the outside very, very difficult and repressive conditions. So although there are, of course, a lot of lots of distinct differences between different national contexts. I mean, for example, in Indonesia, there's very much the, well, the policing and the abuse against the queer community that's very, very distinct. And of course, those have its own dynamics. But by and large, the main argument that we want to make is that there is always room for newsmakers to express agency, even under even under repressive conditions. I guess what we are trying to argue here is not so much to make, like, you know, one single unified argument, but to basically put forward that there are definitely like national differences at play across the region, but at the same time, there may be some similarities as well. I realize that this is a bit of a vague answer, but we're also very cautious about not putting forward like a single blanket statement that simplifies things. And also even where in a case where there are national differences between countries, we want to emphasize that, of course, even within the countries themselves, there are lots of subnational variations. The way something is done in the Malaysian state of Sabah, for example, can be very different from how things operate in the capital of Kuala Lumpur. So I think those are some things that we would like to emphasize a little bit. So perhaps the way that I would like people to think about these reports are as sort of like a lens through which we can, where we can understand some specific experiences within a broader context, but without overgeneralizing from there. I realize this is a bit of a roundabout answer, but I think the longer that we engage in the research process, the more cautious we are about making statements, and hence that means these sorts of roundabout answers. I have to apologize for that, if that's all right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think there's anything, you know, to apologize for, really, because I do believe that caution and, you know, just taking into account all of these nuances are important. Avon, you've been also doing this work. I mean, in UNarrative, we've been doing this research for a couple of years now, but you in Alter Media, you've also been doing work with lots of, you know, in the independent media scene, whether that's with multiple independent media outfits or journalists and, you know, stuff like that. So maybe you can explain a little bit about the work that you're doing and then follow that up with your thoughts on the issues that Wai Lang has brought up.
Alter Media, we are a national network, a media network of more than 30 media outfits committed to promoting pro-people journalism by amplifying the issues and stories of the marginalized sectors. So we focus on unreported and underreported stories, especially on civil and political rights, economic and social cultural rights. So the network have two major responsibilities. One, we serve as a secretariat of the network, and the other, we're also a news organization, so we are newspapers. We work closely with our member media outfits, discussing local stories, various issues and concerns, from safety measures to improving skills and capacities. We deliver, as a news organization, we deliver weekly news broadcasts, analysis, documentaries, and among other formats. Apart from managing the network and its production, a key aspect of our work is engaging communities, primarily through local screenings, local engagement with different communities. This ensures our audience reach and understands the topics we cover and allows us to gather their feedback firsthand. And lastly, we actively campaign to defend press freedom, freedom of expression, and the public's right to information. So that's what Alter Media is doing. So we are connecting with not just independent and alternative media, but we also work with different media, mainstream media. So as we call it, organizations. Primarily because of what we have experienced in the last few years, the shrinking democratic spaces and the attacks on the press. So regarding what William has just shared, I think most, if not all, of these countries have very repressive laws, definitely, that directly prohibits criticism to those in power, or suppressing critical reporting or dissenting views. Just what he said, it is embedded in the bigger context of the media and society. So in the Philippines, there are laws, but that doesn't really directly prohibit criticism, but actually has the equally same impact. Actually, these were mentioned in the draft of the publication. It was mentioned in the publication, the anti-terror law, the libel laws, and etc. And because of this, journalists became easy targets of different harassment, intimidation, arrests. Even the government started to control the internet using laws to control content, even on social media and other digital platforms, leading to concerns about online freedom of expression. Experience that we're just facing right now. For example, we have been reporting regarding the roots of the civil war between the Communist Party led New People's Army or NPA and the government forces. Most of the stories were taken down by social media corporations because the government tagged the NPA as terrorists. But the court said otherwise. A judicial body recently ruled that the war waged by the communists are not acts of terrorism, so they say. So that reportage led to blocking websites of different organizations, including three member outfits of Alter Media, labeling us as terrorist fronts that really made journalists vulnerable to different forms of attacks. For another case, we have Frenchie May Cumpio, our colleague who was a reporter in the Central Philippines. She was tagged as a high-ranking communist leader, and that is used as a justification for her continued detention. It will be, I think, 4 years. She's in detention for almost 4 years now. And I could list numerous cases, but the repression for me appears very similar, varying only in faces, names, and forms in these countries. And maybe a different for the Philippines as a country that claims to be democratic and open to different viewpoints and ideologies, supposedly, signs of tyranny are becoming more apparent, which is, I think, a general description maybe for the other countries in the region. So they will just employ this national security as a justification for prosecuting individuals. And so I think overall, these countries grapple with the challenges to press freedom due to state policies, violence, economic factors, and gender inequality.
Yeah, we keep coming back to the claims of democracy for Southeast Asian governments, right? It's like, yeah, we are open to different viewpoints unless you threaten national security, and then you're a terrorist, you're a communist, and then, oh, okay, different viewpoints, then you're a terrorist and you're a communist. You know, you just use all of these labels in a very roundabout way, and it results in this kind of repressive atmosphere. You mentioned the role of, like, you know, state violence and, again, all of these multiple things, which also appears over and over again in Wai Lang's research, right? So, Wai Lang, I'm going to go over to you now. What are your findings of these? You outlined three specific concerns, which are, like, the state, violence, and capital, right? And then these really, you know, we really need to fix these situations to build better environments for newsmakers and marginalized genders and sexualities. And there are lots of intersections there, obviously. But yeah, I'll let you speak, Wai Lang, about these concerns specifically.
So I think just to contextualize, so what are these emerging areas of concern, which were brought up by our participants? Basically, what we try to do, of course, is to try and problematize that, to talk about how, if you talk about the state as an emerging area of concern, what we try to do here in this report is to problematize that idea of the state as, you know, sort of like a very overarching top-down authority. I mentioned a little bit earlier in this discussion that how the image of, you know, sort of like the all-seeing state is very much just that. It's really an image, because in practice things can be a lot more fuzzy. A.B. Mariani, who was on Southeast Asia Dispatches some time ago, spoke about sort of like politically wired tycoons and how this speaks to, let's say, like, you know, that broader confluence of media and different political actors who may be outside, formally outside of the formal structures of government, as I understand it. And that's what we really want to try and bring up through our research, the idea that while the state seems all-powerful, there are ways of working against it, or there are ways of working against it using sort of like mechanisms of law, for example, and things like that. And I think at the same time, what we also want to be aware of is how states can co-opt what seem to be, you know, like, let's say things that we can all agree on. I think, Bonnie, just now you spoke about how the co-option of discourse related to democracy, but also very importantly is how states can also effectively make use of the values of newsmaking. You can be hired to be a newsmaker in a state-linked institution because you can be critical, objective, and fair, basically speaking to those values which gives newsmaking its I guess for lack of a better term, it's moral authority. And those can be used by state institutions in various ways as well. So it's not just a matter of seeing the state, for example, as, you know, like the big bad guy who manipulates the news at will and that sort of thing. Sometimes the state uses these ideals and it puts them into practice, but in such a way that furthers its own interest. It's something that we would still like to look into further, perhaps in future research, but we're hoping that this research output catalyzes those sorts of questions and discussions moving forward. It links up, of course, to, you know, ideas of hegemony and the media. There have been quite a few interesting studies that are have been emerging in recent times. So those are areas where we would like to encourage further thought. So violence, the second theme that you mentioned, violence, that's a little bit more straightforward. And this, of course, speaks a bit to Avon's own experiences, because here that's where we talk about, let's say, the more salient issues, such as the practice of red tagging, for example, which feels like it doesn't receive nearly as much attention as the quote-unquote war on drugs during former President Duterte's time. But one thing that was really emphasized by our participants in the Philippines was how the logic underlying quote-unquote war on drugs and red tagging are quite similar, in the sense that basically it's about identifying targets, identifying particular targets and effectively directing action against those targets to begin with, whether through like vigilante action or mechanisms of state repression. And also we also looked into very much, so like, again, gendered experiences in this case, whether, let's say, like, for example, a male or female newsmaker would be more targeted by, in terms of, let's say, like physical violence or online violence. There are quite a few nuances that we found over here. And of course, it's a bit self-selecting, because we are limited by whom we can talk to. But judging from previous research that we conducted as well, it appears that while male reporters seem to be at higher risk of physical harm, this may, of course, be correlated with how male reporters are more likely to be sent out into the field. This doesn't mean that there's no violence against a female or a reporter, for example, or someone from the queer community, because violence manifests itself in various ways. It can be discursive. It can be discursive, and of course, this can happen online or in person. And I think that's where we really need to pay attention to the different forms in which violence can express itself. Because, of course, there are already a lot of platforms, organizations out there who are monitoring, let's say, like cases of harm, killings, and that sort of thing. But in our case, we want to try and broaden those parameters further to talk about what else happens on an everyday level in the newsroom outside, and including within the newsrooms themselves. I think moving on to the third point, the third area of concern, this one relates to capital. So we talk about capital in its very broad sense here. So of course, there's capital in the financial sense as we know it. So that relates very much, of course, to economic concerns about whether you can feed yourself as a newsmaker. But also drawing from some experiences from our Philippine participants, they had identified how certain newsrooms, even as much as they speak for, you know, things like human rights or different other sorts of rights, the one thing that seems to evade a lot of organizations is economic rights. So the question of whether you pay, how fairly you can treat or pay your workers, of course, which seems to manifest in different ways, where there can be, let's say, like a reluctance to report on strikes that are happening in other newsrooms. The fear, of course, is that for news owners, is of course your own workers might do something similar. So I think those would be dynamics that we can talk more about. But we also treat capital in its more metaphorical sense as social and cultural capital, for example, how in certain cases, you might need a certain degree of privilege to succeed as in the news, partly because you may not be, I think this was more to do with our Indonesian participants. So some people did emphasize how you actually need to be a particular position where, you know, you have safety nets to fall back upon, because you're going into a very rather precarious profession to begin with. Hence, those are some of the dynamics that we try to emphasize as well. So privilege, precarity, how are these related to each other? And also, we start to talk a bit more about, let's say the perils, but also the freedoms of freelancing. And but freelancing, of course, is part of that. It can, of course, be tied into that broader system of exploitation, paying people by the piece, by the hour, that sort of thing. And while, of course, you can do quite decently as a freelancer, the lack of security is always one concern that comes about. So yeah, looking into all our interviews, we did identify some of the many different threats. And in identifying these threats, we need to put them to write this in a manner that on one hand is simple enough to grasp, but on the other hand allows for lots of room for discussion. And so we ended up with these three areas of concern. The state, violence, and capital.
I'd be remiss not to mention that obviously I myself and Dania, the producer of the show, is very painfully familiar with all of these concerns, especially in the kind of work that we do, and being trans people as well, right? And having these all laid out, and obviously these three are not mutually exclusive, right? So the state is a machine to actually perpetuate all of these violence, and then the violence itself is utilized to maintain the status quo, the distribution of capital, and then a lack of capital will get you more vulnerable to violence and all and so on. But I do really like your point about the state, you know, utilizing values, so to speak, like setting values, defining what values are good and what values are not good. And that really, that also speaks a lot to the experience of, like, queer people and marginalized genders, because obviously, by definition, then, we are defined as bad as the state. So, it has all of these things that you can't really be a good journalist working for the betterment of the country if you're queer, stuff like that. There's a lot of that going on, and especially in online circles with, like, hosts of, like, online bullying that I myself have, like, witnessed. Fortunately, not, like, directly experienced, but, like, witnessed to the people I know. It's pretty severe. I want to move on. Avon, I do want to hear your thoughts on this. But before that, I also want to, I guess we can talk a bit more about the calls that you mentioned, Wailang, on your research about how to actually improve the situation. So can you really quickly just go through these calls, and then we can go to Avon to respond and, like, maybe enhance, give Avon's thoughts on that as well.
Well, I guess we could also think of them as calls for improvement, but I guess it's really up to different individuals working in their different contexts to decide what works best for them. Well, there's a lot of the usual things that are, being more critical of representation, whether in terms of media representations or representation of diversity among the workforce. Well, we also look at things very much like grassroots level stuff, like, empowering student journalists, because I think student journalists don't seem to get quite as much recognition as they should for the work that they do. And of course, very importantly, there's the question of, I think it's very much a question of data, but data goes to the heart of research. What sort of gender data can we get about, let's say, like, newsmakers working across the region, and how important is such data for shaping how we structure policies, take affirmative action, and that sort of thing. I think there's quite a few of these, but I think if I were to try and sum up what we found most interesting, was about how you can create the question of creating egalitarian workplaces, because, of course, at the end of the day, the company that you work in is still a business. It's still a company after all, as progressive as it might be. So the question becomes, like, right, so how can we how can we be fair to everyone, but at the same time, you know, survive in this very awful and cutthroat media environment? So these are some of the questions that we have been circling around throughout the research process, because at the end of the day, we can ask, like, right, so these are what we want to do for, these are what we think would be great for media workers. But the question, of course, comes back to, like, so what incentive is there for the media owners themselves to, you know, like, to take these changes? Because the media, because the companies themselves are under a lot of pressure, and you're in environments where, you know, you're extracting declining revenue out of advertising, or you're depending on grant funders. This, of course, is another tricky topic in itself, but we'll talk more about that in a future upcoming report. So that's why we got very interested in sort of, like, you know, other ways in which a company can be structured. Can you think about collective leadership, for example? How can you reduce, let's say, like, the gulf between quote-unquote senior management and let's say, like, the junior levels? And also, can you actually think about ways in which, you know, like, ownership can be done differently? Is it a matter of, let's say, like, this might work better for, let's say, like, a small organization? Can you be run as a cooperative? Does a cooperative have a structure, can this have a future in this current economic climate? And also, there's also a question, of course, of community. Like, and this was quite an interesting case, because we were speaking to a participant who spoke about how an indigenous community in the Philippines found different ways to support local media outfit, even though they didn't really have a lot of money, but they would basically do things in kind, basically, like, things like providing payment in, well, it was payment in kind, of course, like, with grains rather than in cash, among other things. So those were some of the, those are some of the lessons learned that we found really interesting, because I think at this point in time, we need a way to think outside of the corporate structure, and this is something we'll explore further down the road, but the corporate structure of the media does seem to be quite crippling in many senses, perhaps almost as crippling as the political factors.
Again, economic structures, political structures, they're all very much entwined. But yeah, I want to hear from Avon, though, from your experience, what has it been like working with Alter Media and the independent media outfits that you work with? How do you navigate this landscape?
Actually, Alter Media's principle has always been grassroots and community-oriented, just what William has had shared. We have, you know, unique way of surviving in the Philippines, maybe because of our culture and these close ties with our audience, from workers unions to farmer organizations, women and queer organizations, artist groups, and other communities. And within these communities, we are also training correspondents. We're giving them skills training, ethics of journalism. So we really don't have to physically be there, and they can report on their community themselves. We are also closely working with student journalists, so we are introducing this kind of journalism to them, especially the media studies is Western oriented in the Philippines, so we're trying to introduce this to them and invite them to be part of the network. But there's this broad alliance of college editors in the Philippines, and they are part of Alter Media Network. So yeah, that's the hard part, you know, of surviving, because, you know, this way is not really that marketable, but we're surviving and expanding. Even expanding greater through these efforts of the communities.
What factors do you think have contributed to this? I mean, you did mention, you know, community support, solidarity, and, like, maybe the culture of some of the people in the some of the communities in the Philippines themselves. But despite this situation and despite the shrinking civic space, the shrinking democracy, these things are expanding. Do you think that's been a reaction to the shrinking civic space, that people are actually noticing that and hence supporting more independent media outlets? Or do you think there are other things that's, you know, that needs to be highlighted for this dynamic?
I think yes, or at least for our part. But definitely it is going to be a really hard endeavor, because really the landscape in the Philippines, the public has really lost its trust in the media. So it's something that we are trying to search for solutions. But one thing remains certain amid these circumstances for us. Because whether journalists, whether from mainstream or independent backgrounds, face attacks, they're prepared to come together to defend the profession, the freedom of expression, and the public's right to information. After all, journalists continue to report because the people they serve are brave. So I think it's really about creating this close ties with the communities, so they can, you know, from media literacy to explaining how important the media in this kind of society really serves its purpose.
Yeah, it is a breath of fresh air to, you know, to really see, to really notice how people just navigate these things despite all of those repressions, right? How people just come together. I mean, one might think that, oh, mainstream journalists and independent journalists, you know, you're mainstream, you're not as dangerous and stuff like that. But that's not really the case, right? They do come together. They do fight for similar things in the name of, like, media freedom, in the name of, like, you know, maintaining what little democracy that we have so it doesn't get eroded further, which I think is a very, you know, it's a very important thing to keep pushing for. So in relation to that, in relation to, like, pushing for all of these things and maintaining this kind of, like, connections with the community, maintaining the solidarity, I want to ask how you might see the role of, like, research, because there is, you did mention that media studies are very, very much, like, Western oriented, and, you know, a lot of them don't really connect with the actual on the ground situation in the Philippines or elsewhere in Southeast Asia, right? And you did mention that a lot of the findings on wildlife research and on the media freedom research in general are actually the things that people are concerned with, that journalists and independent media workers are concerned with. So how important do you think it is for us to, like, find out more about how, you know, about whatever it is, about this, the problems, the situations? What are the roles and the dynamics between these community connections, these independent media workers dynamics, and the research that needs to be done? Do you think we need to push certain kinds of research further? Do you think we need to push more for certain angles? What would you like to see in general?
Yeah, I think the research is really helpful in understanding the situation in the region, so we can learn lessons to push for better practices. But at the same time, I think we can get more people to give feedback to the researchers, especially our audience. I think this is one thing that we want to form as a habit to journalists, to be really involved, or not really involved, but to have closer ties. Researchers or doing other studies, because the system has always been detached to the reality. So that's what we have been talking about. We have this responsibility to go deeper into these communities, so they can really, we can understand how they work and how they understand these researches, these studies, and the situation overall?
Yeah, I think it's very much aligned with like the vision of research as activism that we uphold in New Narrative, and that Wa Liang has explained in a separate episode. I think, you know, listeners can go ahead and listen to that to find out more. But it is, sometimes people might think that, oh, it's a media, you know, why don't we just, you know, fight for better things? Oh, obviously it's because state repression. Oh, obviously it's because this and that thing. But after research, we find out that no, actually, you know, there are ways to actually circumvent this. There are nuances in the experiences of like how gendered it is, the media workers themselves, and that the current initiatives, if they're not open to the gender dimension of things, if they, for example, understand the state as a monolithic top-down institution instead of something that's really pervasive, then that informs the kinds of activisms, and that might not hit the right, that might not solve the right problems or even solve any problems at all, right? So I do agree with your response, but also your suggestion, I suppose, that it needs to be a two-way street. After the publication is, I think that's what you're essentially saying, but correct me if I'm wrong, but like after the publication is out there, you would need more feedback from the journalists and, you know, like really make it a living thing of, you know, a conversation, so to speak, between the researchers and the journalists and the independent media workers. Wa Liang, what are your thoughts on that? I believe you do have a similar vision, but maybe you can talk more about that as well.
So we've conducted the research, but what do we do now? How do people use it? And because we are very cognizant that, you know, it's very easy to produce research and to say like, hey, we've done something. But after that, you know, it just sits in a corner and no one really downloads it or reads it. So it's basically just like, you know, one of those deliverables you have to get out there. I think it's something that we would be very open to hearing ideas from, you know, like readers, from practitioners about what you can do with this research next. I mean, the obvious thing that we do is just, you know, produce events that are informed by some of these findings. We can assign the, and of course, if we have those, and of course, those events can sort of like assign the research outputs as sort of like prerequisite readings and that kind of thing. But, you know, that's very like classroom format. But we would like it to, I think ideally we'd like it to, you know, like inform like things like policy decisions or stuff like that. On this note, I had been, well, this is something that ended recently in Kuala Lumpur. So a talk. This was a talk hosted by a media worker who had emphasized how in their work they didn't actually aim for a broad audience, but they aimed for highly specific and highly targeted niche audiences. The reason was because these particular readers would be able to read in detail, and they would be able to affect, let's say, changes from them. These readers, of course, were, you know, people who work in public policy, for example. So if the research could go down, let's say, like a similar route, if it could be both like broad reaching for people at large, but at the same time also quite targeted, I think that might be a nice idea that we would like to strike. But of course, I think that's where we really would like to hear back from folks on the ground about like, hey, so what? How can this research be more useful to you? Because at the end of the day, we don't really just want to be out there collecting data and publishing it, because we would actually like data to then do something in the world.
Have you had any feedback so far? Because I'm also curious about, because we have published like, well, S4P3 about Indonesian Philippines, they're very recent, but like for the Commission, Singapore, Malaysia, and Brunei was published like a couple of months back. I'm wondering if you've had any feedback on that. But also another question would be, after, you know, analyzing these countries separately, and we found a through line, do you feel like there needs to be more research done on how to amplify the similarities between these countries, or might it be more important to like focus on the uniqueness of each country's challenges and like how might we build like, you know, regional solidarity and stuff like that in terms of the current findings and possibly updates and feedback on your research. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, for the first question, very briefly, well, much of our feedback came from our well, at least our research participants, because in the day we run the drafts past them and to get their ideas on, you know, was, and also our community peer reviewers to get their thoughts on whether this makes sense or whether any analysis is lacking. I think for the most part, I think almost everyone was quite happy, at least for those of our participants who were able to get back to us. But I think the challenge is that it's still a matter of us talking to people whom we already know. So I think what we really would like at this, after this point, is to hear back more from the public in general, and to see, and also this, just to see that what kind of impact is happening at the very broad level. Because of course, there are many ways in which the research comes up, not necessarily just in terms of the full-length research reports, which are, well, admittedly, they tend to be very long. But of course, they can be disseminated in various ways, short form content, on IG, that kind of thing. So yeah, we definitely have got some feedback so far, but we always welcome more feedback. Could you repeat the second question? Sorry.
Yeah, speaking of that though, you know, about the feedback and stuff like that, I was also wondering to like follow up on that, whether the feedback, whether you've had feedback about, you know, if we should go in a more specific direction to face unique challenges in each country, or if actually, oh, it's more important to the overarching, you know, the overarching challenge in Southeast Asia is the same, so let's just go transnational, you know, build regional solidarity. Yeah, which one is it from the things that you've been hearing so far?
I mean, honestly, it's always good to have more research within individual countries. That's really helpful as well, because then you get very, very targeted you basically get very, very targeted findings that will be really helpful. I think if we go back to the case of, let's say, the case of red tagging in the Philippines, for example, because then perhaps this can help inform like how you can keep working even on with this very highly specific issue in mind. But on the other hand, of course, then if we focus on the domestic context, then we kind of keep the research sort of stays in a silo, because it's sort of like segregated along the lines of existing polities. We do like the idea of possibly doing something more transnational, but the challenge with it is then that also tends to flatten out a lot of differences and variations. So maybe what might be a sustainable way for research in the future is if we facilitate, let's say, like researchers working on the ground. Researchers here don't necessarily need to be, you know, formal academic researchers, but they can also be practitioners themselves, for example. Or let's say the individual networks, organizations wanted to conduct their own research. Maybe what our role in the future could be is, you know, facilitating the research process, sort of like giving feedback and offering to help out, because of course a lot of people are doing a lot of work on the ground, sometimes very, and I think in many cases it happens very independently, so you might end up inadvertently duplicating the work that someone else is doing. So maybe one thing we might have to think about collectively outside of New Narrative and maybe in concert with what others are doing is to see what everyone else is up to and how we can use our resources wisely and to maximize our funding, that kind of thing. Because of course the other challenge that goes out is that because a lot of this work has to be funded externally by donors, and of course it's a thing where donors, you know, don't really want to duplicate the kind of work that they're doing, so it might just be a matter of optimizing what we have, right, the ways that we're doing things right now, because there's a lot of excellent, very much needed work that's happening on the ground. But the question that follows now is whether or not this is being done systematically and how we can best organize to use for research to, you know, actually do something out there.
Avon, what are your thoughts on this? Because I do feel like we do need to find a balance between, you know, the specifics of each country, but also, you know, going more broadly in a regional level, but more specifically to your work, to Alter Media's work. Do you feel it's like it's now more important to actually expand regionally and get regional support for the independent media workers in the Philippines and vice versa? Have the independent media workers just be supported in a regional level? Or are you more focused on like, you know what, it's very urgent, you know, it's our thing that we're just going to build on a more national level?
Definitely for our part, a regional support is a very, very important, or actually it's equally important now because our system is really not working, I think, from the judicial to the executive, legislative areas. It's not really working, I think. So while we are doing things on our part here in the local, in the Philippines, I think it's a high time for us to reach out and to join different initiatives within the region, the Southeast Asia, solidarity with different journalists, activists, maybe to facilitate, you know, collaboration and mutual support, because, yeah, just what I said. Sometimes international support gives more pressure to the local governments, to the state. So I think it's also the thing for maybe other countries facing the same environment, media landscape. So I can't answer if which should be prioritized, but I think it's equally important for us now.
It's interesting because I think you kind of like, you know, both are equally important, but like with different roles. On a national level, you do get very granular on like the specific challenges. But as you mentioned, the system's not really working all that well if you just want to push things nationally. So the role of the regional solidarity is more for push, for support, for pressure for the government, while the national the national movements are to identify these specific challenges, which I think is a very, you know, it's a great insight. It's like you can't choose. You have to do both. It's just that you assign different roles to like all of these movements. Speaking of solidarity, speaking of regional solidarity, though, this is how we always wrap up our podcast. So what do you think needs to be done first in terms of building this this regional solidarity in support of Alter Media, in support of like independent media work in Southeast Asia in general? How do you build this solidarity, and what can the listeners do? How can the listeners support the building of this solidarity?
New Narrative has been into this initiatives already. I think we have a lot of collaborations in the past, so we really have a positive outlook on the more to strengthening this maybe regional other regional media networks. For now, what we really need, I think we can, you can join us to call for, I think, investigations, or maybe learning more about the red tagging. I think this is just what like William had said earlier. This is the really the unique thing, if not, it is really prevalent in the Philippines. So maybe learning about this and calling for investigations, or writing letters to your embassies, maybe to tell the Philippine government to investigate this or to stop this practice. And of course, our pressing issue as Alter Media is the continued detention of our colleague, French in Mekumpio. You can search for the case updates. But yeah, we're trying to highlight her case as the face of the media repression in the Philippines, because she experienced almost everything from censorship to directly being imprisoned. And it has not stopped there, because she's experiencing red tagging still, even if she's in prison, judicial delays. So this is really something that we want to maybe the region to act on, or at least try to support these calls.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are, you know, activists just get some people really, you know, get the brunt of these violence, and highlighting their cases is very important. There's some, you know, I believe there are lots of activists like that in Southeast Asia, and just highlighting, you know, the similarity between all of these cases, to actually raise awareness that, hey, this is a thing that it's not just a matter of, like, you know, it's not just the problem of independent media workers in the Philippines. It's everywhere. It's like it's the tip of the iceberg for a larger case. And that's why we need to build a regional solidarity. I think that's a powerful, you know, powerful thing, powerful statement. Waliang, do you have any last thoughts on this, and maybe some other things you might like the listeners to do, some other calls to action?
I think not too much more to add on, because Yvonne, you have very succinctly wrapped up again those different modes by which solidarity can be built, even from elsewhere, even from elsewhere within Southeast Asia. I think at least as far as the media freedom research goes, our work is also very much tied to the broader media freedom network. So in a sense, the research effectively serves to complement the kind of activism that the New Narrative tries actively to do, things like legal briefings newsletters, updating on different happenings across Southeast Asia. I think for us, it's also very much the matter of thinking about how we can try and do something more substantial. But I think for now, at least the important step that we would like to do is at least help to build up networks, whether or not they don't have to be very formal networks, but they can be very informal connections between, for example, someone working in Indonesia and someone working in, hypothetically, in Thailand, for example, and at least having those conversations going. That's perhaps maybe the first step towards helping build up something else. We also emphasize, of course, that there are other groups doing very important work at the regional level. So, of course, New Narrative is not the only one, but it helps here to have more redundancy, more people doing the same thing or something similar, as long as they overlap and have that common goal of ensuring greater media freedom.
Yeah, there's no such thing as too much solidarity. There's no such thing as, like, doing too much important work. So everyone, like, you know, just I guess, again, to the listeners, just keep learning, keep, like, you know, keep discovering about all of these cases, not only in your country, but, like, in all around you, and just keep reaching out, keep building all of these connections to people, to independent media workers, and to just push for better civic and democratic space in general. And yeah, thank you so much, Yvonne, for being here, and Waliang for coming back here to talk about your research again. This has been a great and wonderful conversation. Thank you. And that wraps up our discussion with Waliang Tham and Yvonne Ang. From horrific practices such as red tagging to more insidious and often gendered forms of oppression regarding how moralistic ideas of good and bad are communicated through laws and policies, it's very clear that media freedom in Southeast Asia has a long way to go. While each country has its own unique challenges, we all must stand together as a region to resist.
National solidarity is important to tackle specific laws and practices that oppress media workers. But transnational solidarity is no less important for change, as it garners international attention and puts pressure on governments. If you'd like to know more about the campaign to free Frenchie Mai Kumpio, visit altermedia.net/freefrenchiemaikumpio. We'll also leave a link in the show notes. And of course, you can always visit our Media Freedom in Southeast Asia project on newnarrative.com/mediafreedom, all one word. My name is Bonibel Ramatan, and this has been Southeast Asia Dispatches, brought to you by New Narrative and produced by Dania Yudo. I'll see you around.